Haired man lights another torch. He unsheathes the sword on his back. He hesitates, not knowing which fork to take. He finally decides on the one to the right. It's very dark, winding and full of rubble. Condwyrimure's groans in her sleep. Fear grips her. She knows that the way chosen by the white-haired man leads towards danger. She knows at the same time that the white-haired man seeks danger, for it is his profession. The novice thrashes around in the sheets, moaning. She's a dream reader. She's dreaming. She's in an oniric trance. She suddenly knows what is about to happen.
Beware!
She wants to scream, though she knows she's unable to.
Look out behind you! Beware, witcher!
The monster attacked from the darkness, from an ambush, silently and horrendously. It suddenly materialized in the darkness like a flame flaring up, like a tongue of flame. No matter how much he hurried, urged, fumed and stormed, the witcher remained in Toussaint almost the whole winter. What were the reasons? I shall not write about them. It is all over. There is no point dwelling on it. Anyone who would condemn the witcher, I would remind that love has many names, and not to judge lest they themselves are judged. Dandelion, half a century of poetry. Chapter 3. The monster attacked from the darkness, from an ambush, silently and horrendously. It suddenly materialized in the darkness like an exploding flame flaring up, like a tongue of flame. Geralt, though taken by surprise, reacted instinctively. He dodged, brushing the dungeon wall. The beast flew past, rebounded off the dirt floor like a ball, flailed its wings and leapt again, hissing and opening its awful beak. But this time the witcher was ready. He jabbed from the elbow, aiming at the crop beneath the crimson dewlap, which was large, twice as big as a turkey's. He found the target and felt his blade slice the body open. The blow's force knocked the beast to the ground against the wall. The scoffin screamed, and it was almost a human scream. It thrashed around among broken bricks, writhed and fluttered its wings, splashing blood and lashing its whip-like tail around. The witcher was certain the battle was over, but the monster surprised him unpleasantly. It unexpectedly lunged for his throat, croaking horribly, talons outstretched and beak snapping. Geralt dodged, pushed off from the wall with his shoulder, and smote with great force from below, taking advantage of the momentum he'd generated. The wounded scoffin tumbled among the bricks again, and stinking gore splashed on the dungeon wall, describing fanciful patterns. Wounded, the monster stopped thrashing around, and was only trembling, croaking, extending its long neck, swelling its crop, and shaking its dewlap. Blood flowed swiftly between the bricks it lay on. Geralt could easily have finished it off, but didn't want to damage its hide too much. He waited calmly for the scoffin to bleed to death. He moved a few steps away, turned around to the wall, undid his trousers and pissed, whistling a sad song. The scoffin stopped croaking, lay still, and went quiet. The witcher moved closer and poked it gently with the point of his sword. Seeing it was done, he seized the monster by the tail and picked it up. He held it by the base of its tail at hip height. The scoffin's vulture-like beak reached the floor, and its wingspan measured more than 4 feet.
"You're light, Karolashek."
Geralt shook the beast, which indeed didn't weigh much more than a well-fattened turkey.
"You're light. Luckily they're paying me by the piece, not the pound."
"It's the first time," Reynard de Boisfren whistled softly through his teeth, which, as Geralt knew, he did to express the highest admiration. "It's the first time I've ever seen anything like it. An absolute oddity, by my troth. An oddity to end all oddities. Does that mean it's the infamous basilisk?"
"No."
Geralt raised the monster higher so the knight could examine it better.
"It isn't a basilisk. It's a Karolashek."
Is there a difference?
A crucial one. A basilisk, also known as a regulus, is a reptile, but a korolishek, also known as a scoffin or cockatrice, is neither a reptile nor a bird. It's the only member of an order that scholars called ornithoreptiles, for after lengthy debate they found...
And which one?
Interrupted Reynard de Boisfrin, clearly uninterested in the scholar's motives, can kill or petrify with a look.
Neither of them. That's fiction.
Why do people fear them both so much, then? This one here isn't all that big. Can it really be dangerous?
This one here. The Witcher shook his quarry. Usually attacks from the rear and aims unerringly between the vertebrae or below the left kidney at the aorta. One blow of its beak usually suffices. And as regards the basilisk, it doesn't matter where it strikes. Its venom is the most powerful non-neurotoxin. It kills in a few seconds.
Ugh. And which one, do tell, can be dispatched with the help of a looking glass?
Either of them, if you whack it over the head.
Reynard de Boisfrin chortled. Geralt didn't laugh. The joke about the basilisk and the looking glass had stopped amusing him in Kaer Morhen, for the teachers had flogged it to death. The jokes about virgins and unicorns were just as unamusing. The record for idiocy and primitivism was achieved in Kaer Morhen by the numerous versions of the joke about the she-dragon the young witcher shook hands with for a bet. He smiled at the memories.
"I prefer you when you smile," said Reynard, scrutinizing him very closely. "I prefer you much more, 100-fold more like you are now, compared to how you were back in October, after that scrap in the Druid's forest when we were riding to Beauclerc. Back then, let me tell you, you were sullen, embittered, and as sour as a usurer who's been swindled, and as irritable as a man who hasn't had any luck the whole night, or even in the morning."
"Was I really like that?"
"Really? Don't be surprised that I prefer you the way you are now. Changed."
"Occupational therapy."
Geralt shook the korolishek he was holding by the tail. The salutary influence of professional activity on the psyche. "And so, to continue my cure, let's get down to business. There's a chance of making a little more money on the scoffin than the fee agreed for its killing. It's almost undamaged. If you have a customer for a whole one, to be stuffed or prepared, don't take less than 200. If you have to flog it in portions, remember that the most valuable feathers are from just above the rump, specifically those ones, the central tail feathers. You can sharpen them much thinner than goose feathers. They're right more prettily and cleanly, and are harder wearing. A scribe who knows his stuff won't hesitate to give 5 apiece."
"I have customers wanting to stuff a corpse," smiled the knight. "The Cooper's Guild. They saw that vile creature stuffed in Castel Ravello. You know, that dryad waterflea, or whatever it's called. You know the one. The one they clubbed to death in the dungeons, under the ruins of the old castle the day after Samhain."
"I remember."
"Well, so the Coopers saw the stuffed beast and asked me for something equally rarefied to decorate their guild chambers. The korolishek will be just right. The Coopers in Toussaint, as you can guess, are a guild who can't complain of a shortage of orders and thanks to that are wealthy. They're bound to give 220, perhaps even more. I'll try to haggle. And as far as the feathers are concerned, the barrel bodgers won't notice if we pull a few pieces from the Korolishek's arse and sell them to the Ducal Chancery. The Chancery doesn't pay out of its own pocket, but from the Ducal coffers, so they'll pay not 5, but 10 for a feather without a quibble."
"I take my hat off to your shrewdness."
"Numen est umen."
Reynard de Boisfrin grinned more broadly.
"Mama must have sensed something, christening me with the name of the sly fox from the well-known cycle of fables."
"You ought to have been a merchant, not a knight."
"I ought," agreed the knight. "But, well, if you're born the son of a noble lord, you'll live a noble lord and die a noble lord, having first begat further noble lords. You won't change anything, no matter what. Anyway, you reckon up pretty decently, Geralt, but you don't make a living from merchandising."
"I don't, for similar reasons to you, but with a single difference that I won't begat anything. Let's get out of these dungeons."
Outside, at the foot of the castle walls, they were enfolded by the cold and wind from the hills. The night was bright, the sky cloudless and starry. The moonlight sparkled on the swathes of fresh white snow lying on the vineyards. Their tethered horses greeted them with snorts.
"We ought to meet the customer at once and collect the money," said Reinhardt, looking meaningfully at the Witcher. "But you are surely hurrying back to Beauclerc, what? To a certain bedchamber?"
Geralt did not reply, as he didn't answer questions like that on principle. He hauled the Korolishek's remains onto the packhorse and then mounted Roach.
"Let's meet the customer," he decided, turning back in the saddle. "The night is young and I'm hungry, and I fancy a drink. Let's ride to town, to the Pheasantry."
Reynard de Boisfrenne laughed, adjusted a shield with a red and gold checkerboard pattern hanging from the pommel, and climbed up into the high saddle.
"As you wish, my good fellow, the Pheasantry it is. Yah, Bucephalus!"
They went at a walk down the snow-covered hillside towards the highway, which was clearly marked by a sparse avenue of poplars.
"You know what, Reynard?" Geralt suddenly said. "I also prefer you as you are now, talking normally. Back in October, you were using infuriating moronic mannerisms."
"Pon my word, Witcher, I am a knight errant,"
chortled Reynard de Boisfrenne. "Have you forgotten? Knights always talk like morons. It's a kind of sign, like this shield here. You can recognize the fraternity, like by the arms on the shield."
"Pon my word," said the checkered knight, "you needlessly bother yourself, Sir Geralt. Your beloved is surely hale, for she has doubtless utterly forgotten about her infirmity. The Duchess retains excellent court medics, fully capable of curing any malaise. Pon my word, there's no need to distress yourself."
"I'm of the same opinion," said Regis. "Cheer up, Geralt. After all, the Druidesses treated Milva too."
"And Druidesses are expert healers," interjected Caer, "the best proof of which is my very own noggin, which was cut open by a miner's axe, and which is now, take a look, almost good as new. Milva is sure to be well, too. There's no need to worry."
"Let's hope."
"She's hale, your Milva, and hearty," repeated the knight. "I'll wager she's already cavorting at wedding balls, cutting a caper, feasting. In Beauclerc, at the court of Duchess Anarietta, balls alternate with banquets. Ha! Pon my word, now that I've fulfilled my vows, I also..."
"You've fulfilled your vows?"
"Fortune shone on me, for you ought to know that I made my vows, and not just any vows, but on a flying crane, in the spring. I vowed to fell 15 marauders before Yule. I was lucky. I'm now free of my vows. Now I can drink and eat beef. Aha! I don't have to conceal my name. I am, if you will, Reynard de Boisfrenne."
"It's our pleasure."
"Regarding those balls," said Angoulême, urging her horse on to catch up with them, "I hope Platter and Gobbler won't pass us by either, and I'd also love to shake a leg."
"Pon my word, there'll be everything at Beauclerc," Reynard de Boisfrenne assured them. "Balls, feasts, banquets, revels and poetry evenings. Your friends of Dandelions, for heaven's sake. Of Viscount Julian's, I meant to say. And the Lady Duchess is most fond of the latter."
"I'll see. He was bragging about it," said Angoulême. "What was the truth about that love? Do you know the story, Sir Knight? Do tell."
"Angoulême," said the Witcher, "do you have to know?"
"I don't, but I want to. Don't whinge, Geralt, and stop being sullen, for at the sight of your mush, roadside mushrooms pickle. And you, Sir Knight, see on."
Other knights errant, riding at the head of the procession, were singing a knightly refrain from a repeating chorus. The words of the song were unbelievably foolish.
"It occurred these 6 summers past," began the knight. "The poet tarried with us all winter and spring. He played his lute, sang romances, and declaimed poetry. Duke Raymond was actually staying in Sintra at a council. He didn't hurry home. It was no secret he had a paramour in Sintra. And the Duchess and Lord Dandelion..." "Beauclerc is strange indeed, and spellbinding, full of amatory enchantment. You shall see for yourselves. As the Duchess and Lord Dandelion learned then. They noticed not from verse to verse, from word to word, from compliment to compliment, poises, glances, sighs. To put it briefly, both came to an intimate understanding.
How intimate? Chortled Angoulême.
One was not an eyewitness, said the knight coolly, and it is not seemly to repeat rumours. Besides, as my good lady undoubtedly knows, love has many faces, and it is a most relative thing how intimate was the understanding.
Caer snorted softly. Angoulême had nothing to add.
The Duchess and Lord Dandelion, continued Reynard de Boisfren, trysted in secret some 2 months from Belletane to the summer solstice, but they disregarded caution. The news got out. Evil rumours began to spread. Lord Dandelion, without hesitating, mounted his horse and rode away. He acted prudently, as it turned out, for as soon as Duke Raymond returned from Sintra, an accommodating serving lad informed him of everything. As soon as the Duke found out what an insult he had suffered and how he had been cuckolded, he was seized by yellow bile, as you may imagine. He overturned a tureen of broth on the table, cleft the informer lad with a hatchet, and uttered scabrous words. He then punched the marshal's face and smashed a great Coviran looking-glass before witnesses. Then he imprisoned the Duchess in her chambers, and having threatened her with torture, extracted everything from her. At which point he sent after Lord Dandelion, ordered him put to death without clemency, and his heart torn from his breast. For, having read something similar in an ancient ballad, he meant to fry his heart and force Duchess Anarietta to eat it in front of the entire court. Ugh, what an abomination! Luckily, Lord Dandelion managed to flee.
Indeed, and the Duke died.
He did. The incident, as I said, caused him great ill humour. His blood became so heated from it that apoplexy and palsy seized him. He lay like a plank for nigh on a year, but recovered, even began to walk. Only he winked one eye, ceaselessly, like this.
The knight turned around in the saddle, squinted his eye, and screwed up his face like a monkey.
Although the Duke had always been an incurable fornicator and stallion, he continued a moment later, that winking made him even more periculosus in lovemaking, for every dame thought he was winking at her out of fondness and giving her amorous signs, and dames are most covetous of such homage. I in no way impute that they are all wanton and dissolute, by no means. But the Duke, as I said, winked much, almost endlessly. So, on the whole, he got what was coming to him. His cup ran over in his frolics, and one night he was struck again by the apoplexy. He gave up the ghost in his bedchamber.
Atop a dame?
Guffawed Angoulême.
In truth.
The knight, until then deadly serious, smiled under his whiskers.
In truth, beneath one, the details are unimportant.
Verily, nodded Caer seriously. Duke Raymond wasn't greatly mourned, was he? During the tale I had the impression that you were fonder of the inconstant wife than the betrayed husband,
the vampire interrupted in mid-sentence.
Perhaps for the reason that she now reigns?
That is one reason,
replied Reynard de Boisfren disarmingly frankly.
But not the only one. For Duke Raymond, may the earth lie lightly on him, was such a good-for-nothing rogue and, excuse my language, whoreson, that he would have given the very devil stomach ulcers in half a year. And he reigned for 7 years in Toussaint, while everyone adored and adores Duchess Anarietta.
May I then venture, said the witcher tartly, that Duke Raymond didn't leave many inconsolable friends who were ready to waylay Dandelion with daggers.
You may.
The knight glanced at him, and his eyes were quick and intelligent.
And upon my word, you won't be one of the mark. I said, did I not? Lady Anarietta dotes on the poet, and everyone here would walk through fire for Lady Anarietta. The good knight returned to find he'd been spurned, his love had not tarried, but swiftly been married, a chevalier's woe with a hey nonny no.
Crows, disturbed by the knight's singing, took flight, cawing from the roadside thicket. They soon rode out of the trees, straight into a valley among hills, on which the white towers of small castles were framed strikingly against the sky, which was coloured with dark blue streaks. Wherever they looked, the gentle hillsides were covered with neat avenues of evenly trimmed bushes like columns of soldiers. The ground was carpeted with red and gold leaves.
"What is it?" asked Angoulême. "Vines."
"Grapevines, yes," said Reynard de Boisfren. "They're the famed valleys of Sens Retour. The finest wines of the world are pressed from the grapes that mellow here."
"That is true," agreed Regis, who, as usual, was an expert on everything. "The crux is the volcanic earth and the microclimate here, which ensures every year a simply ideal combination of sunny and rainy days. If we add traditions, expertise, and the utmost care of the vine dressers, it yields a result in the form of a product of the highest class and distinction."
"Well said," the knight smiled. "Distinction, indeed. Look over there, say, at the hillside below that castle. Here, the castle gives the distinction to the vineyard and the cellars deep beneath it. That one is called Castel Revello, and from its vineyards come such wines as Evolus, Fiorano, Pomino, and the celebrated Est Est. You must have heard of it. One pays the same for a keg of Est Est as for 10 kegs of wine from Sidaris or the Nilfgaardian vineyards by the Alba. And there, look, as far as the eyes can see, are the castles and other vineyards, and the names are surely no strangers to you either. Vermentino, Torricella, Castel Daccia, Tufo, Sancerre, Nuragus, Coronata, and finally, Corvo Bianco, Quinterbin in the elven tongue. I trust the names are familiar to you."
"They are." Ugh. Angoulême contorted her face. "Particularly by learning the hard way, to check if some rascal of an innkeeper hadn't poured us one of those famous wines, by chance, instead of the usual cider, because then you might have to leave your horse with him. So costly, Castel or Est Est."
"Yuck! I don't understand. It might be quality gear to those great lords, but we, ordinary folk, can get plastered just as well on the cheap stuff. And I'll tell you this, because I've experienced it. You puke after Est Est just the same as you do after Scrumpy."
Caring not for Angoulême's vulgar October jests, Reynard leaned back from the table, his belt loosened. "Today we drink a fine label and a fine vintage, Witcher. We can afford it. We've made some money. We can revel."
"That's right." Geralt beckoned to the innkeeper. "After all, as Dandelion says, perhaps there are other motivations for earning money, but I just don't know any. So, let's eat whatever's behind those appetizing smells wafting from the kitchen. Incidentally, it's extremely crowded in the pheasantry today, though the hour's quite late."
"Why, it's Yuletide Eve," explained the innkeeper, overhearing him. "Folk are wassailing, making merry, telling fortunes, as tradition demands, and tradition here, I know," interrupted the Witcher.
"And what did tradition demand from the kitchen today?"
"Cold tongue with horseradish, cape and broth with brain meatballs, beef roulade served with dumplings and cabbage."
"Keep it coming, good fellow. And to accompany it, what shall we drink with it, Reynard?"
"If it's beef," said the knight after a moment's thought, "then red Cote de Blessure. And the vintage? It was the year old Duchess Caraberta turned up her toes."
"That's the year," the innkeeper nodded. "At your service, sire."
A mistletoe wreath, clumsily thrown behind her by a wench from the next table, almost fell into Geralt's lap. The wench's companions whooped with laughter, and she blushed prettily.
"You're out of luck."
The knight picked up the wreath and threw it back.
"He won't be your future husband. He's spoken for, noble maiden. He's already been ensnared by a pair of green orbs. Be quiet, Reynard."
The innkeeper brought the order. They ate and drank in silence, listening to the reveller's merriment.
"Yule," said Geralt, putting down his cup. mid in Viern, the winter solstice. I've been hanging around here for 2 months. 2 wasted months.
1 month, Reynard corrected him coolly and soberly. If you've lost anything, it's but a month. Then the snows covered up the mountain passes, and you couldn't have left Toussaint, no matter what. You've waited until Yule, so you'll surely wait till spring, too. It's force majeure, thus your grief and sorrow are in vain. While as far as your sorrow goes, don't overdo the pretense, for I don't believe you regretted that much.
Oh, what do you know, Reynard? What do you know?
Not much, agreed the knight, pouring the wine.
Not much more than what I see. And I saw your first encounter, yours and hers, in Beauclair.
Do you remember the feast of the vat?
The white knickers?
Geralt did not reply. He remembered.
A charming place, Beauclair Palace, full of amatory enchantment, muttered Reynard,
savouring the wine's bouquet.
The very sight is bewitching. I recall how you were all dumbstruck when you saw it in October. What was the expression Kaya used then? Let me think.
An elegant little castle, Kaya said in admiration. Well, I'll be. An elegant and pleasing little castle indeed.
The Duchess lives well, said the vampire. You have to admit it.
Fucking nice gaff, added Angoulême. Beauclair Palace, repeated Renard de Boisfren proudly. An elven edifice, only slightly modified, allegedly by Pharamond himself.
Not allegedly, objected Regis. Beyond any doubt, Pharamond's style is apparent at first glance. It suffices to look at those small towers.
The slender white obelisks of the red-roofed towers referred to by the vampire soared into the sky, rising up from the castle's delicate construction, which grew wider towards the ground. The sight evoked the image of candles with festoons of wax flowing over the intricately carved base of a candlestick.
The town spreads out at the foot of Beauclair, explained Sir Reynard. The walls, naturally, were added later. After all, as you know, elves don't wall their towns. Spur on your horses, noble comrades. We have a long road ahead of us. Beauclair only seems close, but the mountains distort perspective.
Let us ride on.
They rode swiftly, overtaking wanderers and goliards, wagons and carts loaded with dark, seemingly mouldy grapes. Then there were the town's busy, narrow streets, smelling of fermenting grape juice. Then a gloomy park full of poplars, yews, barberries and boxwood. Then there were rose beds, mainly containing multiflora and centifolia. And further still, there were the carved columns, portals and archivolts of the palace, liveried servants and flunkies. The man who greeted them was Dandelion, coiffured and arrayed like a prince.
Where's Milva?
She's well, don't worry. You'll find her in the chambers that have been prepared for you. She doesn't want to leave them.
Why not?
You'll find out later. Now follow me. The Duchess awaits.
In our travelling things.
Such were her wishes.
The hall they entered was full of people, dressed as colourfully as birds of paradise. Geralt did not have time to look around. Dandelion shoved him towards a marble staircase, beside which were 2 women, who stood out from the crowd, being assisted by pages and courtiers. It was quiet, but it became even quieter. The first woman had a pointed, turned-up nose, and her blue eyes were piercing and seemed a little feverish. Her chestnut hair was pinned up into an elaborately, truly artistic coiffure, supported by velvet ribbons, complete down to the tiniest nuances, including an unerringly geometric, sickle-shaped curl on her forehead. The upper part of her dress had a plunging neckline shimmering with 1,000 blue and lilac stripes on a black background. The skirt was black, densely strewn with tiny gold chrysanthemums in a regular pattern. The neckline and décolletage, something like a complicated scaffolding or cage, held captive in its intricate coils a necklace of lacquer, obsidian, emeralds and lapis lazuli, ending in a jade cross which almost plunged between her small breasts, which were supported by a close-fitting bodice. The diamond-shaped neckline was large and plunging, bearing the woman's delicate shoulders, and seemed not to offer adequate support. Geralt was expecting the dress to slide from her bust at any moment. But it didn't, and was held in its proper place by the mysterious arcana of dressmaking and the buffers of puffed sleeves. The second woman equaled the first in height. She was wearing the same lipstick, and there the similarities ended. This woman wore a net cap on her short black hair, which metamorphosed at the front into a veil extending to the tip of her petite nose. The veil's floral motif didn't mask her beautiful, sparkling eyes set off by green eyeshadow. An identical floral veil covered the modest décolletage of her long-sleeved black dress, which in several places was scattered with an apparently random pattern of sapphires, aquamarines, rock crystals, and gold openwork stars.
"Her enlightened ladyship, Duchess Anna Henrietta," someone whispered behind Geralt's back. "Kneel, sire."
"I wonder which of the two," thought Geralt, bending his painful knee clumsily into a ceremonial bow. "Both look just as bloody eye-born, not to say regal."
"Arise, Sir Geralt," said the one with the intricate chestnut coiffure and pointed nose, dispelling his doubts. "We welcome you and your friends to Beauclerc Palace in the Duchy of Toussaint. We are delighted to be able to offer lodging to people on such a noble mission, people, furthermore, being bonded in friendship with Viscount Julian, who is so dear to our heart."
Dandelion bowed deeply and vigorously.
"The Viscount," continued the Duchess, "has disclosed your names to us, revealed the nature of your expedition, and said what brings you to Toussaint. The tale touched our heart. We shall be glad to converse with you at a private audience, Sir Geralt. That matter must, however, be somewhat postponed, since state duties make their demands upon us. The grape harvest is over, and tradition demands our participation in the festival of the Vat."
The other woman, the one in the veil, leaned over towards the Duchess and quickly whispered something. Anna Henrietta looked at the witcher, smiled, and licked her lips.
"It is our will," she raised her voice, "that Geralt of Rivia shall serve us in the Vat alongside Viscount Julian."
A murmur ran through the group of courtiers and knights like the whisper of pines struck by the wind. Duchess Anarietta shot the witcher another smouldering glance and left the hall with her companion and a retinue of pages.
"By thunder," whispered the checkered knight, "I'll be damned. Quite some honour has befallen you, witcher, sir."
"I don't quite understand what this is about," Geralt admitted. "In what way am I to serve Her Highness?"
"Her Grace,"
broke in a portly gentleman with the appearance of a confectioner approaching.
"Forgive me, sire, for correcting you, but in the given circumstances I must do so. We greatly respect tradition and protocol here in Toussaint. I am Sebastian Le Goff, Chamberlain and Marshal of the Court."
"My pleasure."
"Lady Anna Henrietta's official and protocolary title,"
the Chamberlain not only looked like a confectioner but even smelt of icing,
"is Her Enlightened Ladyship. Her unofficial one is Her Grace. Her familiar one beyond the court is Lady Duchess, but one should always address her as Your Grace."
"Thank you. I shall remember. And the other woman? How should I entitle her?"
"Her official title is the Honourable,"
the Chamberlain informed him gravely.
"But addressing her as Ma'am is permissible. She is kin to the Duchess and is called Fringilla Vigo. In accordance with Her Grace's will, you are to serve her, Madam Fringilla, in the Vat."
"And what does this service consist of?"
"Nothing difficult. I shall explain soon. As you'll see, we've used mechanical presses for years, but nonetheless tradition."
The courtyard resounded with a hubbub and frenetic squealing of pipes, the wild music of recorders and the demented jingling of tambourines. Tumblers and buffoons dressed in garlands cavorted and somersaulted around a vat placed on a platform. The courtyard and cloisters were full of people, knights, ladies, courtiers, and richly attired burghers. Chamberlain Sebastian Legoff raised up a staff twisted around with green vines and struck it 3 times against the podium.
Hear ye, he cried. Noble ladies, lords and knights.
Yea, replied the crowd.
Yea. Welcome to our ancient custom. May the grape prosper. Yea. May it mellow in the sun.
Yea, may it mellow.
Yea. May the trod grape ferment. May it gather strength and taste in the barrel. May it flow tastily to goblets and thence to heads, to the glory of majesty, comely ladies, noble knights, and vine-dressers.
Yea, may it ferment.
Let the beauties step forward.
2 women, Duchess Anna Henrietta and her black-haired companion, emerged from damask tents on opposite sides of the courtyard. They were both wrapped tightly in scarlet capes.
Yea.
The chamberlain struck his cane on the ground.
Let the youths step forward.
The youths had been instructed and knew what to do. Dandelion approached the Duchess and Geralt, the black-haired woman, who he now knew was called the Honourable Fringilla Vigo. The 2 women cast off their capes as one, and the crowd greeted them with thunderous applause. Geralt swallowed. The women were wearing tiny, white, gossamer-thin blouses with shoulder straps revealing their midriffs, and clinging, frilly knickers, and nothing else, not even jewellery. They were also barefoot. Geralt picked Fringilla up, and she quite eagerly put an arm around his neck. She smelled faintly of ambergris and roses and femininity. She was warm, and her warmth penetrated him like an arrowhead. She was soft, and her softness scalded and nettled his fingers. They carried them to the vat, Geralt, Fringilla, and Dandelion, the Duchess, and helped them alight on the grapes, which burst and spurted forth juice. The crowd roared,
Yea!
The Duchess and Fringilla placed their hands on each other's shoulders, and, by supporting one another more easily, kept their balance on the grapes, into which they had sunk up to their knees. The must squirted and sprayed around. The women, turning, trod the grapes, giggling like schoolgirls. Fringilla winked at the witcher, quite against protocol.
Yea,
shouted the crowd.
Yea, may it ferment.
The crushed grapes splashed juice. The cloudy must bubbled and foamed copiously around the treader's knees. The chamberlain struck his cane against the planks of the platform. Geralt and Dandelion moved closer, helping the women out of the vat. Geralt saw Anarietta pinch Dandelion's ear as he carried her, and her eyes shone dangerously. It seemed to him that Fringilla's lips brushed his cheek, but he couldn't be certain whether intentionally or not. The smell of the must was heady and intoxicating. He stood Fringilla on the podium and wrapped her in the scarlet cape. Fringilla squeezed his hand quickly and powerfully.
"These ancient traditions," she whispered, "can be arousing, can't they?"
"They can."
"Thank you, Witcher."
"The pleasure's all mine."
"Not all yours. I assure you, not all yours."
"Pour the wine, Reynard."
More Yuletide prophecies were being carried out at the next table. A strip of apple peel cut into a long spiral was thrown down, and the initial letter of one's future partner's name was divined from the shape it arranged itself into. Each time, the peel formed itself into a letter S. In spite of that, there was no end to the mirth. The knight poured.
"It turned out that Milva was well," said the witcher pensively, "although she still had a bandage around her ribs. She remained in her chamber, though, and refused to leave, not wanting at any cost to put on the dress she'd been presented with. It looked as though there could be a protocolary scandal, but the omniscient Regis pacified the situation.
After courting a good dozen precedents, he made the Chamberlain bring a mail outfit to the archer. Angoulême, for a change, joyfully discarded their trousers, riding boots and foot wraps, and Soap, a dress and a comb, turned her into quite a pretty lass. All of us, let's face it, were cheered up by the bathhouse and the clean clothes. Even me. We set off for the audience in a very decent mood.
Stop for a moment.
Reynard gestured with his head.
The business is heading towards us.
Oh, and not one, but two vineyards. Manatesta, our customer, is bringing a comrade. And a rival. Wonders will never cease.
Who's the other one?
Pomerol Vineyard. We're drinking their wine, Côte de Blessure, right now.
Malatesta, the steward of the Vermentino Vineyard, had noticed them, waved and approached, leading his companion, an individual with a black moustache and a bushy black beard, who resembled a brigand more than an official.
Gentlemen, Malatesta introduced the bearded man, Mr. Alcides Firebrass, steward of Pomerol Vineyard.
Sit you down.
We're here for but a moment to talk to Master Witcher regarding a beast in our cellars. I conclude from seeing your good selves here that the monster is killed.
Dead.
The agreed sum, Malatesta assured him, will be transferred to your account at the Canfanelli's bank tomorrow at the latest. Oh, thanking you, Master Witcher. Thanks a hundredfold. Such a gorgeous cellar. Vaulted, north-pointing, not too dry, not too damp. Just what's needed for wine. And owing to that vile brute, it couldn't be used. You saw yourselves. We needs must brick up all that part of the cellar. But the beast managed to find a way through. Where it came from is anyone's guess. Probably from hell itself.
He spat on the floor.
Caves, hollowed out in volcanic tuff, always abound in monsters, instructed Reynard de Boisfrain wisely.
He had been accompanying the Witcher for over a month, and being a good listener, had managed to learn a great deal.
It goes without saying, where there's tuff, there's sure to be a monster.
Very well, perhaps it was tuff.
Malatesta glared at him.
Whoever that tuff happens to be, but folk are saying it's because our cellars are connected to deep caverns that are said to lead to the very centre of the earth. There are many similar dungeons and caves like that around here.
Like under our cellars, to give the first example that springs to mind, said the black-bearded Pomerol Vineyard. Those dungeons go on for miles, but no one knows to where. The men who wanted to unravel the matter didn't return, and a dreadful monster was also seen there, they say. I therefore like to suggest...
I can guess what you want to propose, said the Witcher dryly, and I consent to the proposition. I will explore your cellars. We shall set the fee, depending on what I find there.
You won't do badly,
the bearded man assured him.
One more thing.
Pray speak.
That succubus that haunts men at night and torments them, which her enlightened ladyship, the Duchess, has ordered killed, I believe there's no need, for the ghoul doesn't bother anyone, in truth. Yes, it occasionally haunts, bedevils a little.
But not but adults,
Malatesta quickly interrupted.
You took the words out of my mouth, friend. All in all, the succubus doesn't harm anyone, and recently there's been no word about it at all. Doubtless it would be scared of you, Master Witcher. What, then, is the point of tormenting it? Why, you aren't lacking ready cash, sire, and were you to be short,
something could be transferred to my account at Canfanelli's bank, Geralt said with stony countenance. To the witch's pension fund.
So be it.
Then not a single blonde hair on the succubus's head will be harmed.
Farewell, then.
The two vineyards stood up.
Feast in peace, we shan't disturb. It's a holiday today, a tradition here in Toussaint. Tradition is sacred, said Geralt.
I know.
The party at the next table were making another noisy Yuletide prophecy, carried out with the help of balls fashioned from the soft inside of cakes and bones left over from a carp. The wine was flowing as they did so. The innkeeper and the serving girls were rushed off their feet, hurrying to and fro with jugs.
The famous succubus, remarked Reynard, serving himself more cabbage, began the memorable series of witcher contracts that you took on in Toussaint. Then things speeded up, and you couldn't keep the customers away. Funny, I don't remember which vineyard gave you the first contract. You weren't present. It happened the day after the audience with the Duchess, which you didn't attend either, as a matter of fact. No wonder. It was a private audience. Private, huh? Snorted Geralt. It was attended by some 20 people, not counting the motionless lackeys, youthful pages, and a bored jester. Among that number was Legoff, the chamberlain, with the appearance and smell of a confectioner, and several magnates bowing under the weight of their golden chains. There were several coves in black, counsellors, or perhaps judges. There was the baron with the bull's head coat of arms I met in Caed Mirkvid. There was, naturally, Fringilla Vigo, a person evidently close to the Duchess. And there we were, our entire gang, including Milver in male costume. I was wrong to speak of the entire company. Dandelion was not with us. Dandelion, or rather, Viscount What's-His-Name, sat sprawled in a curule seat on her pointy-nosed Highness Anrietta's right hand and postured like a peacock, like a real pet. Anrietta, Fringilla and Dandelion were the only people seated. No one else was permitted to sit down. And anyway, I was glad they didn't make me kneel. The Duchess listened to my tale, seldom interrupting, fortunately. When, however, I briefly related the results of the conversations with the druidesses, she wrung her hands, in a gesture suggesting worry as sincere as it was exaggerated. I know that sounds like some sort of bloody oxymoron, but believe me, Reynard, in her case, that's how it was.
Oh, oh,
said Duchess Anna Henrietta, wringing her hands.
You have sorely worried us, Master Geralt. Truly do we tell you that sorrow fills our heart.
She sniffed through her pointed nose, held out her hand, and Dandelion at once pressed a monogrammed cambric handkerchief into it. The Duchess brushed both her cheeks with the handkerchief so as not to wipe the powder off.
Oh, oh, she repeated. So the druidesses knew nothing about Ciri? They were unable to help you? Was all your effort then wasted, and your journey in vain?
Certainly not in vain, Geralt answered with conviction. I confess I'd counted on obtaining some concrete information or hints from the druids that would at least explain in the most general way why Ciri is the object of such a relentless pursuit. The druids, though, couldn't or didn't want to help me. And in this respect, I indeed gained nothing, but... He paused for a moment, not for dramatic effect. He was wondering how frank he could be in front of the entire auditorium. I know that Ciri's alive, he finally said dryly. She was probably wounded. She's still in danger, but she's alive. Anna Henrietta gasped, applied the handkerchief again, and squeezed Dandelion's arm.
We pledge you our help and support, she said. Stay in Toussaint as long as you wish. You ought to know that we have resided in Sintra, and we knew and were fond of Pavetta. We knew and liked little Ciri. We are with you with all our heart, Master Geralt. If needs be, you shall have the assistance of our scholars and astrologers. Our libraries and book collections stand open before you. You are certain, we deeply trust, to find some track, sign or spoor that will indicate the right way. Do not act hastily. You need not hurry. You may stay here as you like. You are a most welcome guest.
Thank you, Your Grace. Geralt bowed. Thank you for your kindness and favour. We must, nonetheless, set off as soon as we have rested a little. Ciri is still in danger. When we stay in one place too long, the threat not only grows, but begins to endanger the people who show us kindness, and unrelated strangers. I wouldn't want to allow that to happen for anything. The Duchess was silent for some time, stroking Dandelion's forearm with measured movements, as you would a cat.
Your words are noble and virtuous," she said at last. "But you have nothing to fear. Our knights routed the ne'er-do-wells pursuing you, so that none escaped with his life. Viscount Julian told us about it. Anyone who dares to trouble you will meet the same fate. You are under our care and protection."
"I value that." Geralt bowed again, under his breath, cursing his knee, but not only his knee. "Nonetheless, I cannot omit to mention something Viscount Dandelion forgot to tell your enlightened ladyship. The ne'er-do-wells from the mine who pursued me to Belhaven, and whom your valiant knighthood vanquished in Caed Mirkvid, were indeed ne'er-do-wells of the first water, but they bore Nilfgaardian livery."
"And what of it?"
It was on the tip of his tongue to say that if the Nilfgaardians had captured Adian in 20 days, they would need just 20 minutes to capture her little duchy. "There is a war on," he said instead. "What happened in Belhaven and Caed Mirkvid may be regarded as a diversion at the rear that usually results in repression. In wartime..."
"The war?"
The Duchess interrupted him, raising her pointy nose.
"Is definitely over. We wrote to our cousin, Emir Var Emrys, regarding this matter. We sent a memorandum to him in which we demanded that he put an end forthwith to the senseless bloodletting. The war is sure to be over. Peace is sure to have been concluded."
"Not exactly," replied Geralt coldly. "Fire and sword are wreaking havoc on the far side of the Yeruga. Blood is flowing. There's nothing to indicate that it's about to end. Quite the contrary, I'd say." He immediately regretted what he'd said.
"What?"
The Duchess's nose, it appeared, became even pointier, and a nasty, grindingly snarling note sounded in her voice.
"Did I hear right? The war is still raging. Why wasn't I informed of this, Minister Tremblay?"
"Your Grace," I mumbled one of the golden chains, genuflecting, "I didn't want to concern you, worry, Your Grace."
"God!"
Her Majesty howled.
"To the tower with him!"
"You are in disfavour, Lord Tremblay. In disfavour. Lord Chamberlain, Mr. Secretary."
"At your service, Your Enlightened Leadership."
"Have the Chancellery immediately issue a severe note to our cousin, the Emperor of Nilfgaard. We demand that he immediately, and I mean immediately, stop swearing and makes peace. For war and discord are evil things. Discord ruins and accord builds."
"Your Grace," mumbled the Chamberlain confectioner, as white as caster sugar, "is absolutely right."
"What are you still doing here, gentlemen? We have issued our orders. Be off with you this instant."
Geralt looked around discreetly. The courtiers had stony expressions, from which he concluded that similar incidents were nothing new at the court. He made a firm resolution only to say yes to the Lady Duchess in future. Anna Rieta brushed the tip of her nose with a handkerchief and then smiled at Geralt.
"As you see," she said, "your anxieties were unfounded. You have nothing to fear and may rest here as long as you like."
"Yes, Your Grace." In the silence, the tapping of a Death Watch beetle in one of the pieces of antique furniture could be heard distinctly, as could the curses being hurled by a groom in a distant courtyard.
"We also have a request for you, Master Geralt."
Anna Rieta interrupted the silence.
"In your capacity as a witcher."
"Yes, Your Grace."
"It is the request of many noble ladies of Tussar, and ours at the same time. A nocturnal monster is plaguing local homesteads. This devil, this phantom, this succubus in female form, so lewd that we daren't describe it, torments our virtuous and faithful husbands. She haunts bedchambers at night, committing lewd acts and disgusting perversions, which modesty forbids us to speak of. You, as an expert, surely know what the matter is."
"Yes, Your Grace."
"The ladies of Tussar ask you to put an end to this abomination, and we add our voice to this request, and assure you of our generosity."
"Yes, Your Grace." Angoulême found the Witcher and the vampire in the palace grounds, where they were enjoying a walk and a discreet conversation.
"You won't believe me," she panted. "You won't believe me when I tell you, but it's the honest truth."
"Spit it out."
"Reynard de Boisfrain, the checkered knight-errant, is standing in a queue before the ducal treasure with the other knights-errant. And you know for what? For his monthly salary. The queue, I'm telling you, is half an arrow shot long, and it's sparkling with coats of arms. I asked Reynard what it's all about, and he said errant knights also get hungry."
"So what's the problem?"
"You must be joking. It's knight-errant's noble vocation to wander, not for a monthly salary."
"The one does not preclude the other," said the vampire Regis very gravely. "Truly, believe me, Angoulême."
"Believe him, Angoulême," said Geralt dryly.
"Stop running around the palace looking for scandal and go and keep Milva company. She's in a dreadful state. She oughtn't to be alone."
"True. I think Auntie's got a period because she's as angry as a wasp. I think Angoulême."
I'm going.
Geralt and Regis stopped beside a bed of slightly wilted centifolia roses, but they were unable to talk any longer. A very thin man in an elegant cloak, the colour of umber, emerged from behind the orangery.
"Good day."
He bowed, brushing his knees with a Martin Kalpak.
"May I ask which of you gentlemen is the witcher known as Geralt, and renowned for his craft?"
"I am he."
"I am Jean Gatillon, steward of the Castel Torricella vineyards. The fact is that a witcher would serve us very well in the vineyard. I wish to find out if you would not consider..."
"What is it about?"
"It is thus," began Steward Catillon. "Owing to this damned war, merchants visit more seldom. Our reserves are growing, and there is less and less space for the barrels. We thought it was a small problem, for beneath the castles, the cellars go on for miles, ever deeper. But I think the cellars extend to the centre of the earth. We also found a little cellar at the Torricella, a beautiful, if you please, vaulted, not too dry, not too damp, just right for the wine to mature."
"What of it?"
the witcher interrupted.
"It turned out that some kind of monster prowls in the cellar, if you please, which probably came from the depths of the earth. It burned two people, melted their flesh to the bone, and blinded another, because he, I mean the monster, sire, spits and pukes some sort of caustic lye."
"A solpuga," Geralt stated bluntly. "Also called a venomer."
"Well, well," smiled Regis. "You can see for yourself, Lord Catillon, that you're dealing with an expert. This expert, one might say, is a godsend. And have you turned to the renowned local knights errant in this matter? The Duchess has an entire regiment of them. And missions like these are, let's face it, their speciality, their raison d'être."
"Not at all." Steward Catillon shook his head. "Their raison d'être is to protect the roads and passes, for if the merchants couldn't get here, we'd all be reduced to beggary. What's more, the knights are bold and valiant, but only on horseback. None of them would venture onto the ground. What's more, they're expen—"
He broke off and fell silent. He had the expression of a person who, if he could, would kick himself, and greatly regretted it.
"They're expensive."
Geralt finished off the sentence without excessive spitefulness.
"So you ought to know, good sir, that I'm more expensive. It's a free market, and there's free competition. If we sign a contract, I'll dismount and head underground. Think it through, but don't bother too long, for I'm not staying long in Toussaint."
"You astonish me," said Regis, as soon as the steward had gone. "Has the witcher in you suddenly revived? Are you accepting contracts? Going after monsters?"
"I'm astonished myself," replied Geralt frankly. "I reacted instinctively, prompted by an inexplicable impulse. I'll weasel out of it. I'll treat every quote they offer as too low. Always. Let's get back to our conversation.
Hold on."
The vampire gestured with his eyes.
"Something tells me you have more clients."
Geralt swore under his breath. Two knights were walking towards him down the cypress-lined avenue. He recognized the first at once. The huge bull's head on a snow-white tabard couldn't have been confused with any other crest. The other knight, tall, grey-haired, with nobly angular physiognomy, as though carved from granite, had 5 gold demi-fleur-de-lis on his blue tunic. Having stopped at the regulation distance